This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Trevor Horn, multi-million selling record producer, live performer, and the man who invented the 80s. Still delivering a prolific output of record releases and touring around the world with the Trevor Horn Band, playing his favourite bass guitar at concerts, which in Brazil start at 2 in the morning, being so hot during the day. He's reimagined the 80s, assembling a 65-piece orchestra and singing talent to front it, including Robbie Williams, Seal, Rumour, Simple Minds, and even reinterpreting his own best works. Yes! Trevor's won 3 Brit Awards for Best British Producer, a Grammy for Seal's 1994 hit Kiss from a Rose, and in 2010, the Ivor Novello Award for Outstanding Contribution to British Music. Born in County Durham 70 years ago, Trevor's father was a semi-professional musician himself and taught young Trevor the basics of double bass. And he'd even fill in for his dad in the Joe Clark Band when he was late for a gig himself. Trevor then taught himself to play the bass guitar. In 1980, he married Jill Sinclair, and they have 4 children, including Aaron, who's followed Dad into the business as a musician and a producer. Jill passed away in 2014, the victim of a tragic accident after 7.5 years in a coma. As you'll hear, he can phone anyone up and make new sounds, like Rod the Mod.
Wake up, Maggie. I think I got something to say to you. It's late September, and I really should be back at my school. I know I keep you amused, but I feel I'm being used. Oh, my, I couldn't try anymore.
I thought of converting to Judaism a few times because I believe in it much more than I believe in pretty much anything else.
Trevor was confirmed into the Christian faith by the Bishop of Durham as a teenager, but has attended synagogue regularly for over 30 years.
The Jewish faith, it says, seek the fortune or seek the success of the city to which you have been exiled. You know, and I think that's the way you have to look at Jews. That's what they do. Jews try and make things better. They're in a country and they may not, you know, they've got a slightly separate religion, but if you need help with anything, they're an amazing resource, you know.
We'll discuss his journey into Judaism later, and in opening our interview by asking him to reflect on his career, a word to the wise in the style of the legendary American comic George Burns.
This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Privilege, yeah, it's a privilege to be alive. Yeah, if I wasn't alive, I couldn't look back on it. So yes, it's definitely a privilege. You know, I kind of like to keep doing new stuff as well. You know what I mean? I can get a bit bored with the old stuff sometimes. I was lucky enough to make some good records with some really great people.
Now, you have reimagined the 80s orchestrally, bringing it back for a new generation and a chance to work with a new generation of stars like Robbie Williams. Mm. And then also was going back with Simple Minds and Tony Hadley and a reprise with Seal as well.
Yeah, no, it was basically anybody I could lay my hands on who I thought could sing the songs. So I wasn't too bothered about where they came from. It was obviously going to be older people because that's the more the kind of people I would have immediate access to.
With Robbie Williams, so you pick up the phone to him and say, look, this is what I want you to sing. Relationships are quite informal. It didn't take you very long, did it?
No, you know, when you've made a record with somebody, a few records, you know, they know that you'll get them sounding good. And they always are for doing something, you know. And I knew Rob would like to do that song. And it sounded great, you know, everybody wants to rule the world. When I told him about it, I sent him a mix of the backing track and he loved it. So that opening is so cool, you know, with the orchestra. It's so happy. Taking music that people listen to when they were younger, and I suppose if one is being honest, there's an element of putting a coating of sugar on it, you know, to make it easier to digest.
But there's something orchestral about your original work too. The perfection of the studio, when you take pieces like Art of Noise, when you take Owner of a Lonely Heart.
Yeah, well, we were all musicians, you know, so we're all musicians, and you know, we sort of. How can I say, whether you're working with an orchestra, pop music, it doesn't matter if it's with an orchestra or with a band, you know, it's the same thing. We're all surprisingly similar musicians.
Is there an element of George Martin in the inspiration for you to be a producer? Because he was such a perfectionist, an analogue perfectionist in some ways. I mean, you've had the benefit of digital.
George, what was good about George Martin was that he managed to sort of produce the Beatles without screwing them up, you know? And that's a big thing for a producer. Producers can really mess bands up. And George Martin didn't mess them up, he just made them better all the time. And if you think about it, no one's ever really topped his string arrangements for pop records. George Martin did the best ones. Somehow he could, they weren't cheesy, you know? They were, I mean, that sort of string quartet arrangement for Eleanor Rigby is something else, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think maybe it's a sextet or whatever, but it's an amazing arrangement. It's brilliant. It's sort of, I don't know, he could do it without being corny. If you think about the contrast between that and something like Phil Spector's, you know, Long and Winding Road, which is still good and I like it, but boy, is that a cheese ball arrangement, you know.
Up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong?
I used to meet George a lot, actually. At loads of awards things, I used to talk to him. Of course, I used to ask him about the Beatles. What was it like? What were they like? You know, I didn't ask it like that. I would go in from the side, maybe. But but it was funny, actually. You know, when you work, when I worked with Paul, you know, I spent a lot of time in the studio with Paul, and I used to think, man, he was just one of four of them, and he's a proper live wire. Sorry, he can play anything. Full of ideas, great fun. I had a good time with him. We did like three really good tracks for an album called Flowers in the Dirt. It would have, must have, I would love to have watched them at it. There's a, I was looking through some old footage of them playing Hey Jude, and I was thinking what a good acoustic guitar part John Lennon was playing. He was playing this sort of funny part, but boy, it really worked with the piano. They were good, you know. I can't remember where the question started. You were talking
about it's a good answer.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So I just want to just take this opportunity to unpack what you think a producer is. It's like a sort of modern day conductor, isn't it?
You see, if you think, where did producers actually start? Why did you need a producer in the first place? What did they actually do? I can only go back a certain distance, but I know back in the day when people like Frank Sinatra and was recording in the 40s and the 50s, the main sort of person that you might associate with being a producer would be the arranger. The producer would be a staff guy working for whatever the record label was, and his job would be to just oversee the session and make sure that it got recorded. The arranger would have written the arrangement in conjunction with Sinatra, whether it was Nelson Riddle or someone else like that, you know. So the job was a slightly different job. For instance, in 1965... the guy that produced Like a Rolling Stone wasn't even credited on the record. He was a staff producer for CBS. As the sort of technology became more complex, back in the 50s, the technology was simpler, but it required a lot more people to work it, and it had, you know, you had to make a record in a certain way, and it was possible to do overdub, but that was a new thing and people didn't really understand it. The first 8-track didn't actually come out until the end of the 50s. The more technology came in, the more the producer became like a kind of bridge between the technology side of it and the artistic side of it. And then, I suppose, you know, if you think about it, one of the reasons that George Martin was such a good producer for the Beatles is he'd made comedy records before. And so he was good at sort of sound effects and all kinds of stuff, you know? And suddenly the producer wasn't just a jobbing guy employed by the record label. He was somebody that started to be creatively involved in the making of the record. And the more the technology became, you know, the more you could do with what you got, the more you needed a producer. So by the end of the 70s, if you went into a studio and you wanted to make a decent sounding record, if you did it yourself, man, it would sound shit. You need to do it with a producer. Because the producer knew what was going on in the studio, knew what you could do, how drums could sound, you know? And then, you know, when it went from sort of, you know, when I started, it was, you know, 8 to 16, 16 to 24, 24 to 48, boy, that was a learning curve. You know, there, it was a whole different world. Mm. You know, I'm going to write a book about it at some point. Learning how to work all that gear, you know, learning how to get stuff to sound takes years, you know. Well, it used to. Now they teach it in university. Talent, I always think, should better be expressed as a sort of aptitude or a desire.
Yeah.
Within reason, if there's something you want to do, even if you're not that well equipped for it, if you want to do it enough, you'll figure out a way to do it, you know? And I think it's more to do with having the desire to do something. Some people might think that they wanted to make a record, but the reality is spending days and days sometimes, especially back in the day, where you really had to create the thing on tape, trying to get it to sound right. When you sort of refer to a kind of perfection, I was one of the first people to be in a position to actually do something that was more or less perfect, because I was the first person who could literally manipulate everything, you know? And that all sort of happened at the beginning of the 80s. When I say hard work, it's not hard work like digging a road, although with some people you can get the feel like that. You know, when I had an artist once who wanted to do 50 takes of every line, you know, literally, and man, that was purgatory.
So obviously the job of the producer became more and more complicated with the technology, but now we're seeing pop stars selling their wares in a less conventional way. They're not selling it via CDs, their downloads. And so what impact has that had on record producers? You know, the idea of producing a masterpiece in the studio is slightly diminishing, isn't it? Because everyone has to go on tour to make money.
Yeah, producers have suffered the most probably out of anybody. What most producers do now is take a piece of the song. The thing is, I never used to take a piece of the song because, A, most of the time I published it. Even if I didn't, I still didn't try and take part of this. Unless I actually wrote something, I never took anything. But that's, you know, stretching it, because a few times, you know, we really did write stuff. Something like the whole middle section of Welcome to the Pleasure Zone, that was like 10 minutes in the middle, means two lips, and, you know, they never wrote that. They wrote like a 3-minute song.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time we published them, and I always thought it was the price of freedom. That if I wasn't going for any of the publishing, then nobody could complain when I told them the song wasn't right. Because some producers are like, the song's not right, I've rewritten it for you, and you've got to give me 15% of it. But you know, when I did things like Owner of a Lonely Heart, I wrote the verses and the tune and the lyrics for Owner of a Lonely Heart, so I got, you know, 20% of that.
Yeah.
So your question was, producers are having a tough time, but
yeah.
It's not something that you could do. People can't pay for it, really. Things don't get produced in the same way. Records aren't, you know, made, unless they're old-fashioned records, which are made very specifically for a market. Say, like, you know, this album I've just done. You know, a lot of things just start from people, they call it writing session, but in fact they're making a kind of a record, you know.
What's the record that springs to mind as the one that's most memorable, the one that you spent so much time perfecting?
I suppose if I think of Owner of a Lonely Heart, it's a really interesting record because it's such an interesting collection of things, and it works so well. 12 inches were great because that's, people liked them. They weren't like the single, they had stuff on
them. And the other thing about them was they were $1.99 and not 85 pence.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a complaint from a customer 30 years on.
Thank you.
So you're still touring. Yeah. You're still performing as a bass guitarist.
Yeah, I like to play. It's a really nice feeling playing with a bunch of musicians, you know.
Who do you play with?
Well, most of the time I'm playing with I've got a band. So I could, it's nine-piece band, nine of us. We've been together for a while now. Most of the other guys are young. Me and my old friend Lord Cream and a guy called Ash Sohn, and I play with the Dire Straits lot, you know, Alan Clark, Steve Ferroni, and all that lot, you know. I'm off to Brazil with them next month for 10 days. Well, actually 15 days. That's quite, being on the road, you know, in Brazil is no joke, especially when you get to my age, because it's like, sometimes the gig's at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know.
Really?
Not, yeah, because it's too hot during the day.
Right, wow, that is late. Or early, as the case may be. So production really is where you made your name after a performance career in the 70s. And this is, in no small credit, to your late wife, Jill Sinclair, who encouraged you to take the step. What was it that she saw in your sort of talents that steered you towards this success?
Jill understood what I did, and so she got me to do the right thing, you know. I'm like a Black and Decker drill, you know, it's no good if you drill a hole in the wrong place. So, and Jill knew where to put the drill and get the trigger and get it going. She was very good at that.
You're listening to Johnny Gould's Jewish State. If you like my regular podcasts, please think about making a donation. My podcasts are free, and I want to keep them free, and so donations really help me keep them that way. Head over to my donations page at www.patreon.com/Johnny Gould.
So, Trevor, I have been going to South Hampstead Synagogue for 15 years, although I've been coming more recently on Saturday more regularly, and it was a bit of a surprise to see you in there, being such a fan. I was looking at this guy thinking, that bloke looks like Trevor Horn. Oh, never mind. And then sort of looking around at everyone, and then I'm looking back at you and thinking, that bloke looks like Trevor Horn. That is weird. And then I plucked up the courage after a couple of weeks, say, excuse me, are you Trevor Horn? Mm-hmm. To which you kindly said yes. But as long as I can ever remember, you've been coming to synagogue every Saturday morning. You're 30, not Jewish. Why?
30 years, I think, now.
Well, that's quite, you know, that's quite an attendance record. Why did you do
it? Well, I don't know how good my attendance record is. I can't make any claims for being a devout Orthodox Jew. And anyway, well, I mean, it's obvious. I have four Jewish children. Being Jewish goes through the mother, so my children. Jewish, so in a way, you know, my late wife was a very strong character, and she really liked South Hampstead. You know, her brother-in-law, Yaakov Osher Sinclair, works at Or Samech in Jerusalem, and he said to her one day, you know, look, if you're going to drive to a Masorti synagogue, why don't you drive to an Orthodox synagogue? And I thought, well, that makes perfect sense. Why not? Why not indeed, right? And so we changed. But then she said, we started to go to this place in Marble Arch. The guys wore top hats. It was kind of, I don't know, I wasn't so crazy about it. But then, her brother told her about this rabbi, Shlomo Levine. So she came back, she went over to see him. I remember she came back to him and she said, you're going to like this guy. We're going to go to this new synagogue on Shabbos and you're going to meet him. So I guess I started going, and that was probably just over 30 years ago, 32 years ago.
But not every person who marries a Jewish woman who isn't brought up Jewish or has any Jewish connection.
Yeah.
Goes to synagogue for 30 years.
Yeah, I was never very crazy about church, but I was confirmed, you know, as a Christian. You know, when I was 14, I had to go in front of the bishop. It all didn't make much sense to me.
Was this the Bishop of Durham?
Bishop of Durham, you got it. Yeah, and
that's quite a big bishop.
Yeah, well, Durham's got a fantastic cathedral.
It does.
Amazing place. So I got quite interested, you know, I got quite interested in the Jewish faith, and I read a lot about it, you know, I read, and it seems to me, once you get to know Jews, and you read the Torah, it all starts to make sense, you know, where it all seemed a bit third hand, you know, when you're learning it in the Christian terms, but Jews kind of live it, they live a lot of it. And for whatever reason, I've been vegetarian, and so if I eat a bit of fish, but only kosher fish, and also for like nearly 30, over 30 years now, so I never eat, you know, I haven't eaten anything, never have anything treif in the house, I really try, it's a slog, believe me, Jewish parents have got my sympathy, I know how hard it is, keeping it out. I suppose in a way too, I felt like it was something I could relate to, you know, and I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't liked it. No one forced me to. Although it was a nice time, you know, we started a walk to synagogue. For a while we were sort of quite sort of observant, really. And then, you know, you sort of lapse again, you know, a bit. I thought of converting to Judaism a few times because I believe in it much more than I would believe in pretty much anything else. But at the moment it would be very hard for me because, you know, when you play a lot of concerts, quite often they're on a Friday night, you know. And it's hard because of the way that financially it's all set up. It's hard to say, I can't do that, you know.
Yeah.
And while you're on, did you catch these episodes? Press the subscribe button. Scroll back for the unrepentant Julie Burchill.
Ani Rotza, meaning I want, highlights the impatience and the apparent insolence of Israelis. On my first visit there, when I had the last echo of my good looks, I remember the baffled Israeli boy who hit on me with the words, I want, you want. When I protested that I was married, he retorted, he no here, you want, I want. These days, I'm not above playing the flaky old lady card to get through security sharpish. I always pack my Hebrew textbook at the top of my hand luggage, and when the Fearsham operative seizes it and asks, do you speak Hebrew? I answer in my rustic child's voice, Annie Oevet, Ketuvim Bekeleven. I love cats and dogs. The effect is nothing short of miraculous, as the stern face breaks into a smile and a cry of whatever the Ivrit is for, here, come and listen to this freak, you won't believe it, rings out across the El Al check-in area. Hebrew is difficult, beautiful, rebellious, and most importantly, the sensible choice for me, as I can't imagine a time when I won't want to keep going back to the land where they speak it, no matter how rude they are.
How lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you for that.
And for an all-time hero, scroll way back to episode 38, to a timeless story of Mossad's mission 700 kilometres behind enemy lines in Sudan, as Danny and his agents partnered with Ethiopia's Jews to bring them home to Israel.
Suddenly in 1982, Israel was plunged into war in Lebanon. More than once, you left your posting in Sudan to perform your national service. So you motorbiked up the country, up to Israel, on your Kawasaki, to join your elite paratrooping unit to fight intensively against Syrian forces. You fought in a war north of Israel, literally days after your humanitarian mission in Sudan. How does a man deal with that, psychologically?
When you say it, it looks like this guy is crazy.
It sounds unbelievable.
Well, but that's very Israeli, you know.
And Eddie Cohen gets to ask me questions too, like this one about our late queen. Why didn't she ever visit Israel?
First question.
Yeah, the simple reason for that is that the Foreign Office would not sanction a trip for the Queen. But in recent years, Prince Charles and the Duke of Edinburgh...
No. Why, Elizabeth, during 60 years?
I know.
Why?
And she was from, and she would have appreciated the Via Dolorosa and Bethlehem and...
So why?
Nazareth.
Why?
The Foreign Office would not allow it.
Nah.
Really?
Nah.
But Prince William has been now with an official visit.
The Foreign Office can dictate to Queen Elizabeth to go or not to go?
Correct. Do you know what the initials of the Foreign Office are? F-O, which is... There you go.
But your religious conviction with Judaism is therefore to say, I see it for myself. I see you reading the Torah portion in English. Yeah. And really, really pouring through, really looking for its meaning.
No. Well, that's what you go there every week for. It's like a time for reflection. And then I always end up with someone's for lunch somewhere. You know, it's great.
It's a form of meditation for you, Trevor?
It's also, when my late wife had her accident, you know, and suddenly I was responsible for everything. You know, I was a child. I didn't know how to do anything. And the synagogue were very helpful over certain things, you know. There was one point where I was selling a house. I'd never sold a house before. Never really dealt with an estate agent myself before. And one of my friends, I remember, he wrote a script for me. And then I got an offer, and then I remember calling him, what do I say now? And he said, someone's going to come and look at your house tomorrow, and then I'll tell you what to say. And the next day, some guy who I'd seen at synagogue showed up. Went, hi. I'm just going to look round, and went. And then the next day, my friend called me up. He said, right, have you got a pen? This is what you're going to say. You're going to say, I want sealed bids over this 5 1/4, and I want them by next Wednesday. And whoever gets the furthest over 5 1/4 will get. And when I said to the estate agent, he said, you're mad, you're crazy. I said, I'm just reading the script. I said, that's what I want to do, right? He called me back the next week. He said, sit down. He said, you're a crafty one, aren't you? He said, you won't believe the offers we've had. I just followed the script. That was all from synagogue, you know. It made me laugh when he said, you're a cunning one, you know.
So the community that you find within the synagogue and the Jewish community is something perhaps I might venture to suggest is even richer than the musical community that you must have such great warmth with as well. Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, I don't sort of differentiate between the two things. Jews are a lot of, you know, all musicians, in order to get up on a stage and play an instrument, they're all a certain kind of person. And musicians generally get on with each other, you know? Well, they try to. And, you know, when you're in a band, it's like being in a family, literally like being in a family. Mm-hmm. Everybody looks after each other. And all musicians are stars in their own show. You know, in their own movie, you know this, and Jews are exactly the same. All Jews are stars in their own movie. You know, it's a kind of it comes with the turf, and I understand that. You know, it's it means though that you get some of the best conversation. You know, it's I always like talking to people, and some of the best conversations. You know, the people you bump into. You know that. You wouldn't normally meet, you know, like someone like Roger Gerson, who's an immigration lawyer, but, you know, really interesting people that can tell you real stuff about the world, you know.
It's true. I mean, you know, here I am sitting with you.
Yeah.
Because I am Jewish, because I noticed you in synagogue.
Yeah.
And this podcast, this idea that I came up with, and which you are the sixth guest of,
oh, right.
has provided me with a sort of mobility and access to people that... Just sitting down here, this fifth former in Birmingham in my grammar school in 1982 that said, by the way, in 2019 you're going to be sitting in Trevor Horn's front room, yes, the ABC bloke, sitting and talking about this because he's a member of the Shore, which you're going to go and live in London by all these years later is quite something. I mean, you know, I see you there. It's lovely to see you there, and. The community
feel guilty that I don't go enough.
Well, yes, it's not far, is it?
Well, it's going to be not far, but it hasn't opened up yet.
No, that's right. So, I mean, is it something? Perhaps, I mean, obviously, notwithstanding commitments to sort of Friday night and Saturday night concerts. Is it something really that you would build to, or is it something? I mean, actually, you don't need to convert to come on a Shabbos, do you? You don't need. No,
of course not. You don't need to, and no one asks. It's been so long, I suppose. The thing is, you know, when you're a musician and you're trying to get somewhere in the music business, all the way through my 20s, I didn't come from a social system that I wanted to go back into, you know? I was like you, I went to grammar school, and then I, you know, failed all my O-levels, so I had to earn a living, and then I became, you know, I was a professional musician from then on. You don't have much of a social circle outside of other musicians, because you lead a different life, you know? You work on New Year's Eve, you work on Christmas Eve, you work in the evenings when everybody's off, and when everybody's at work, you're out with nothing to do, which is wonderful, believe me. Mm-hmm. It was one of the nicest things about being a professional musician. So, meeting my late wife and sort of gradually getting into sort of North London Jewish society was the first time I'd ever really, apart from, you know, when I was living in Kobach Terrace, and because my mother's name up in Hetton Lee Hole up in Durham, and because my mother's name was Betty Lampton, and everybody knew the Lamptons, I was Betty Lampton's lad, and I was untouchable. Anybody lays a hand on you, get bread, because you're Betty Lampton's lad. I grew up with really rough men around, and you know, I wore glasses from when I was 4, so I was always regarded as Brains. They used to call me Brains. I would, Trevor, read a book in hell, as they used to say about me, because I used to read all the time.
Right.
But they were all very nice to me.
Yeah.
I suppose coming to, you know, but I left Durham, you know, when I was 16, and that whole side, my mother's side of the family were miners, and mm-hmm. my father's side were school teachers. You know, my father's older sister was the local headmistress, so it was my father's family kind of disowned him after he married my mother a little bit, because she came from miners, that stuff, you know. It's interesting. So when I first started to meet, there's an interesting lack of classlessness about Jewish society.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, I have some, my dearest oldest friend is very English middle class, and he's a lovely man, you know. Every time he comes to synagogue, he always says, man, if I let a string with vodka at the end of the service, I'd go to church. But, you know, it's... So what I'm saying is, I was probably looking for something to identify with, really. So when you're a musician, you're just out there in the middle of nowhere, yeah. Where you know. And I also seen everything from both sides. I've seen it from, you know, not having to... I know what it's like to have no money, you know, and I know what it's like to have a bit of money, you know. The one good thing about it is that if you've got money, it saves you having to worry about not having any. Because if you don't have any, that's the biggest problem. You know, I've got to eat, I've got to pay the rent.
Do you think your journey into sort of North London Jewish society, as you put it, is a kind of a sort of longing for many people, actually, and not that they should become Jews, but the fact that they're isn't a definable enough society, a community around individuals today, that is a richness of the Jewish community, that there is such a support mechanism.
Yeah, if I look back on it, I wouldn't have been drawn to it if I hadn't liked the people. That was the thing, that I just met a lot of people that I liked. Some of them were crazier than others.
You found that out.
Some of them were plain nuts, but generally they were all likeable, yeah. And interesting, and I'd never really been anywhere where you met that many interesting people, you know. I suppose, put simply, it wasn't anything that I felt was sort of forced in any way. And then of course I used to come with my late wife's father a lot, you know, David, and I used to sit with them, the old guys, they're all gone now. Mm. Back in the day, him and what was his name? There was a whole the guy that was the chaplain for all the prisons.
Right.
A lovely bunch, you know. Maurice Ostro's father-in-law, Charles. I haven't seen him for a while. You know, I spent lunches with Charles listening to him talk about his life in Paris in the Second World War, you know. That's what you don't get. And that's what you get. The synagogue, it's people and being together, you know, and helping each other. And if anybody from the synagogue asks me for help, I try and help, you know. I mean, the thing is, the people that are in the synagogue set the tone of it in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And Southampton is an interesting place because it's not like your usual synagogue, but then your usual synagogue probably isn't like your usual synagogue anyway.
Trevor, what would you say to the growing issue of anti-Semitism, to the people who call themselves anti-Zionists, people who are behaving in such a reprehensible way that putting pressure under so many Jewish people, questioning their Britishness, and really a lot of people in the synagogue and around Jewish life are thinking, how long can I live in this country? What's your message?
I don't know, in the Jewish faith it says, seek the fortune or seek the success of the city to which you have been exiled. You know? And I think that's the way you have to look at Jews. That's what they do. Jews try and make things better. They're in a country and they may not, you know, they grow a slightly separate religion, but if you need them to help with anything, they're an amazing resource. You know? And you know that what they're doing, they've pretty much been doing for a few thousand years, so there's a certain kind of stability to it. That's, you know, some people might think that was me being a bit naive, but that's what I actually believe. And I think in a way that, you know, I firmly believe that the Jews are kind of like the canary in the coal mine, that once the Jews start getting a rough time, you know, it's not getting good. Now, as far as where is this coming from, I think if you look in America, that there's a lot of really good communication in America between the Muslim community and the Jewish community. The Muslim community in America, the Islamic community, has really come out and you know, and been up front
mm-hmm.
a few times. As well they should, because, you know, once all that stuff starts, it's not good.
Are you playing catch-up with Johnny Gould's Jewish State? I've had the pleasure of some really great guests. How about Douglas Murray?
Israel is a rare country in the West in that it does buck many of the trends. I mean, there isn't a fertility rate problem in Israel. For instance, as there is in most European countries, there is a strong feeling of nationhood and of the debts that the country needs to call upon in order to unite its people.
And Hillel Neuer, whose UN Watch keeps check on the excesses and mission creep of the UN human rights in Geneva.
The challenges are great. They're not going away. I am concerned by the cultural revolution that we've experienced in America in the past 5 years, known to some as the woke revolution, where there's a kind of a McCarthyism. If you say something, it could be canceled and fired from your university, from your corporation, from a journalist. And often it's an anti-liberalism. So that, to be honest, really scares me, because we need our democracies to be healthy, to be honest, to be truth tellers. So I am deeply concerned.
If you like Johnny's regular podcasts, think about making a donation at either patreon.com/Johnny Gould or buy him a coffee. He loves coffee. ko-fi.com/Johnny Gould.
I don't know where it's coming from. At the moment, you do have a situation where for better or for worse, the whole thing in Israel is a cause, has become a bit of a cause. You know, the Palestinians have got themselves to be like new South Africans or whatever amongst young people. And so Israel, you know, if you don't take a balanced view of it, it's possible. And then, of course, you can equate that once you start to think about that. If you look at it in proportion, it's very difficult to for somebody to just dip in. It's so easy to paint Israel in this way. But if you actually look at what's going on in the Middle East, behind all of this, you know, the idea that that you could force somebody to make peace in a situation where really, you know, to be honest, no peace is actually possible. And it hasn't been possible since 1948. Mm-hmm. It'll take a massive shift of something, I don't know what, to kind of sort it out. And at the moment, they just have to contain it. It's all down to the same thing. People short of money. The thing is, if they could get any kind of sensible leadership in Gaza that wanted to make a difference, the difference would be astonishing. But they don't. It's still the same old thing. There's lots of things you could do. I think the young Palestinians, because I've had a couple of Palestinian boys over for lunch, and we actually put money into a studio in East Jerusalem that we built, Saam. And boy, are they tired of their leadership, you know. But it takes two to tango. God help them. Anybody who can sort that one out. It's like the fights between the family fight. It's the worst. And it's in Israel. It's almost like that, you know.
To miss an opportunity.
I've used that one, boy. You don't want to use it around the people I talk with. They get furious.
I realise.
Never miss an opportunity. Look, they've never been coming at it really from the angle that they were actually going to make peace. They've just been coming from all kinds of angles, but not that one. And at the moment, it's worse than it's ever been because Abbas looks really weak. He's going down. You know, what the hell's going to happen then? And, you know, Gaza just goes from bad to worse. They're taking, you know, sacks of money in there. I mean, it's crazy. You know, so the Hamas lost the press over here when they executed 20 people in the street.
Yeah.
Since then, I've hardly seen anything about Hamas in the paper over here. That was like, forget it. You know, it's horrible. Imagine living under that. We can't imagine it.
No. You must have encountered within the music business, within the entertainment trade, some form of anti-Semitism. You walk in a skull cap. I've seen you in the street in wearing a koppel.
Yeah,
I think that's good. I mean, I don't do that.
Yeah,
fair play.
I'm terrible because sometimes I'm like, bring it on. But no, I'm silly.
But they use words like apartheid.
Of course they do. They try to wind Jews up. Anything like that, you know, winds Jewish people up. It's like use all the words against them that they've used for themselves. You know, use the Nazis against them.
Yeah.
Call them Nazis. Compare them to Nazis.
Yeah.
And Jews get upset by it. Yeah, it's just name calling. But man, if you had to deal with all those mofos, you'd be, because it's a different world and we can't understand it over here. And sitting here and having all these sort of ideas about what it should be like. I understand why they do it. It's like a new cause, like Che Guevara. It's like they managed to get it like an iconic thing, you know.
Yeah.
got me talking.
You don't mind me talking about this, do you?
No, I don't. I argue with a lot of my friends about it. You know, I have a friend, Stuart Copeland, who's very pro-Palestinian, and he grew up in Lebanon. He was bombed by the Israeli Air Force, so he's got a bit of a grudge.
You're talking about the Police drummer?
Yeah.
I absolutely love his work.
He understands Jewish people, but he gets... He and I, we've worn it out now because we used to shout about it. You know?
There's a thread here. My grandma, Oliver Sholem, was from Newcastle.
Right.
And she was a straight-talking person. Is there... And she was Jewish as well, obviously. And so I'm asking, is there something in the Jewish character of straight-talking that's sort of cutting to the chase, the reality about being a Geordie, being from...
Yeah,
the Northeast, and being involved in the Jewish community, which has a lot of parallels.
Yeah, well, I suppose I came from a family where there's a very strong mother. My mother was very strong, and that's quite a Jewish trait, you know? Geordies is, pretty straight talk, but they're not so much on the emotion.
No.
You know, the psychiatrist said to me that my upbringing had been repressed, you know, emotionally, but I don't see it. It's called stiff upper lip, I think you can call it.
Trevor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was lovely.
If you like Johnny's regular podcasts, think about making a donation at either patreon.com/Johnny Gould or click on the PayPal icon on the donations page at jewishstate.co.uk or buy him a coffee. He loves coffee at coffee.com/Johnny Gould. That's ko-fi.com/Johnny Gould.